It is believed that 75% of silent films are permanently lost. I hate to hit you with such an upsetting fact, but it's the one that has long haunted me the most about pop culture, so now I suppose I'm passing the ghost on to you. 75%. According to a 2013 study by the Library of Congress, quote, only 14%, about 1,575 of the feature films produced and distributed domestically from 1912 to 1929 exist in their original format, end quote. That's staggeringly low, consequences of an era that didn't properly place value in the art that they were creating. Some of the existing films are incomplete, and others are in a poorer quality, degrading from years of being tossed aside or totally forgotten. Dig through the filmographies of some of the greats of cinema history from this era, and you will find a litany of stories, some only their titles remaining, because there's nothing left to be seen. Film historians still search through archives and backrooms of movie theaters or libraries, hoping a random canister they open will contain a print of one title they thought never would be seen again. But most are gone forever. They were made of a poor material, of course. The nitrate film stock could easily burn or just crumble to dust, and in fact, the hubris of the film industry led to many of the original negatives being just flat out destroyed, intentionally. Some of the stars saw the value of preserving them at the time, but many did not, and they soon vanished into thin air, only their legends remaining. For silent film fans like myself, this is a quiet, weird tragedy. We don't really know what we're missing, but the loss is palpable. The silent film era was a complicated one. As the era of Buffalo Bill Cody came to an end, the era of cinemas soon took over. Circuses and Wild West shows were a thing of the past. Who needs real-life cowboys on stage before you telling tall tales of their exploits out on the frontier of this country when you could look through a magical window and believe that you, in fact, are there? Buffalo Bill telling stories on a stage was one thing, him recreating his adventures in a field was another, but that was all performance. The film could make it come alive and take you there. It's there, just beyond that screen, on that wall. But as one technological advancement pushed out another, so too would something new drop a hammer on the cinema industry and change the landscape entirely. That new development was synchronized sound. What's standard issue for us today was newfangled technology at the time, thought to maybe even be a passing fad, the same way that silent pictures were to the showmen of the circus days. If you wanted to see people talking and hear it at the same time, go to the theater. If you wanted people doing mad stunts with just some violins and pianos backing them up, that was what the cinema was for. But the future was coming, and soon the talkies would take over all Hollywood production and put a whole lot of filmmakers plumb out of luck. Some didn't adapt to the post-silent era. Maybe their comedy or dramatics just worked better when you couldn't, hear them. That's what the movie Singin' in the Rain is all about. Maybe the silent stars just didn't have that good of a voice. But Hollywood was rattled by the idea, and they soon started speculating how to keep the industry alive. Some filmmakers found themselves venturing to create new forms of Hollywood, some new places to create their art. Some tried, where else, but in Florida, and some would find themselves falling flat on their butts. Florida in the 1920s was a land of opportunity. Prohibition couldn't stop it. With a growing land boom and the prospect of luxury flowing down our sandy shores, people from all over the country would seek opportunity in the Sunshine State. But when the Great Depression came, the economy of the whole country changed. Florida was affected first. The 1930s became an era of confusion. Could all the things we created in those glory days of the 1920s sustain, or would the 1930s be the era where our sandcastles were swept away in the surf? One filmmaker came to Florida to ask that very question. A comedy legend well ahead of his time, the great Stoneface, one of my favorites, Buster Keaton. A legend of 1920s silent cinema, the new era had left him questioning what place he had in the film industry anymore at all. With personal strife on all sides and a professional reputation at stake, an offer was made to him in the early 30s. Come to St. Petersburg, Florida, and make movies. Oh, and we'll give you a lot of money to do it. By the time he left Florida, most reports indicate that Buster Keaton never even touched a camera, let alone shot an inch of film in the Sunshine State. I'm Nick D'Alessandro, and this is Wait 5 Minutes, a podcast about Florida by a Floridian. This week, I'm telling you about one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, the great stone-face Buster Keaton. He endeavored to bring cinema to the beautiful city of St. Petersburg some 90 years ago, a failed effort with a glorious story, as per usual, a stunt of Buster Keaton-sized magnitude that ended how Buster Keaton's tricks usually did, with him falling hard. I love this story. I learned about it from the excellent book Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century by Dana Stevens, who is a magnificent author. I actually listened to her audiobook, which was read by her. It was phenomenal. Huge fan. One of my favorite books I've read in a long time. I must recommend it to you if you're a Buster fan, a cinema fan, anybody. It's extremely illuminative about this era of silent film and Buster as a person. As I was listening to it and Dana said that Buster came to St. Pete, I knew that I would have to tell you about what happened because I needed more answers myself. Because the story goes back a little bit earlier than Buster arriving, because it wasn't just in St. Petersburg. It was in a very unique location, one we've never talked about on this show. There's a few routes you can take to the lovely peninsula of St. Petersburg. One takes you by the interstate, somewhat ignoring the beautiful interior coastline of St. Pete that faces back toward the state. You see the coastline, sure, and the silhouette of the city skyline in the misty distance, but you'll miss the foliage that roams down the coastline if you take this route, the surprising hidden gems that hide along the Tampa Bay coastline. I took that trip last summer out onto the water with our pals, and since then, I've visited St. Pete a couple times, and each time, I've stared out my car window, remembering all the little treasures waiting out there. One such treasure is a uniquely named island, an island that isn't actually really an island at all anymore. The name sticks around because of what it used to be, a relic of a time when high tide would separate the land of Whedon Island and turn it into its own spot of nature and water. Now, it's more of a peninsula with mangrove alleyways crisscrossing its preserve, sort of a bunch of little waterways that connect through the land. Named for an amateur archaeologist, Dr. Leslie Whedon, the quote-unquote island is 3,139 acres, a wetland worth diving into, and I will in the future, I promise. Apparently, Whedon Island actually had man-made mosquito control ditches that were built in the 1950s. They were built to introduce, quote, fish and other animals that eat mosquito larvae, end quote. That's maybe the first successful mosquito control story that I've ever heard of. It seemed like it actually worked at the time. Nevertheless, Whedon Island is a natural wonder, hidden just south of the bridges that lead you across Tampa Bay onto the St. Pete Peninsula. But Whedon Island was known 9 decades ago as a place of unusual opportunity, a place where Hollywood filmmakers could try in vain to revive their careers. Like the island in name only, thanks to changing tides, these stars were now only stars in name only, their profile drastically shifting with the times and the tides. St. Petersburg itself wasn't exactly faring too well in the 1930s. Like all other major cities in Florida at this time, the land boom went bust. How many times have I used that line on the show? What was once a profitable place for land development had become less so, turning to a huge waste of cash for those who sought to develop land. Miami was the city that was hit the worst, but the beachfront property of St. Pete fell to the same traps. In fact, it would take a massive federal investment to save this city. The whole country was grappling with the Great Depression, and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal brought a flush of federal cash to cities that badly needed it, including St. Pete. The Public Works Administration, which would fund and build projects all over the country, came to St. Pete as well. The PWA across the country would create the Hoover Dam out west, the Lincoln Tunnel in New York, and even the overseas highway that connected Miami to Key West, a step up from Flagler's Overseas Railroad from earlier that century. With that funding, the city of St. Pete found a way to survive and even built the City Hall in 1939 that still stands in St. Pete to this day. But long before these projects brought that shot of money to the city, this filmmaking industry plan seemed like it could be a revival for everybody. I find it a little tragic that the city needed help, these filmmakers needed help, and they thought maybe together they could make something special, they could bolster each other. The city needed a new industry, the industry needed a new city, and they were a match made in lackluster heaven. I'm sorry to say it, they did not know that this plan was doomed. Let's jump back a bit. these are dominoes falling, right? But you got to stack the dominoes before you start pushing them over. There's this amazing little book about Whedon Island called The Whedon Island Story, developed by Pinellas County back in 2005, and it's got a ton of this history laid out. I will include a link so you can read even more about this surprisingly rich vein of Florida history. It's given me a few other ideas of stuff we can come back to. But Leslie Whedon, the namesake of the island, he actually was the grandson of Frederick Whedon, the doctor who put Chief Osceola's head in a jar after his death back in the 1830s, a disgusting story that we will dive into another time. I've wanted to talk about Osceola more on this show, and that is one horrendous chapter in it. But Leslie was a doctor himself who studied diseases like yellow fever, but also enjoyed doing archaeology. He explored the mounds on the island that would soon bear his name and built a home there. But in 1923, he sold the land to a developer, one Eugene M. Elliott. It was prohibition now, and bootlegging allowed speakeasies and clubs to pop up to host illegal bars for people to partake in booze. Leslie Whedon's house became a speakeasy, the site of shootouts, quote, among local bootleggers over who was going to provide the liquor to the club, end quote. But when the original structure burned down, Elliott got to work in building a new structure, a club he called the San Remo Club. He dreamed of Whedon Island becoming a hotspot of nightlife and hotels. Though if you look at it on a map, it's hard to imagine that this was going to be a hub of entertainment. It wasn't that spacious, it wasn't that centralized, it was kind of just off the, it was kind of just a little finger sticking off of the peninsula. I find it odd that he wanted it to be something really that entertainment driven. He called it a Riviera, but that did not work out in his favor. San Remo operated a huge dance floor. It had a 50-foot tower, which it's hard to imagine, and it also, of course, ran its illegal bar business. For what it's worth, it seemed to be an actual draw in this era, but like I said, the boom was followed by bust, and the housing market went kaput in 1926. Elliott's property was foreclosed on by the bank. When the stock market went kaput in 1929, the bank went kaput too. The dominoes, my friends, they're falling. But the investors in this era still saw potential in Whedon Island, and they continued to develop the land even as money ran dry. An airport was actually built in 1929, and it actually became, quote, the first commercial air service from Tampa to St. Petersburg, end quote. This little spot on the map still had some life in it as the 1930s tried to somehow bring money back to the city. Then came the movie producers. Hollywood history is filled with endeavoring creatives who arrive to town. Which town? Any town. But they arrive to town with an idea. Their tenuous ties are enough to gain them a reputation when they arrive. And that seems to be what happened in the case of T.C. Parker, who rolled up into town in April of 1933. This book says he had a, quote, background in the movie industry, end quote, but all the research that I could find shows his ties were these productions, the movies that were made in St. Petersburg at this time. I have absolutely no information about T.C. Parker III, I think, maybe. Do you know how rare it is to find someone who kind of doesn't exist? But T.C. Parker, man, I don't know. All I can find is that he did this studio. That's it. He opened this studio on Whedon Island. Parker created Sun Haven Movie Studio, and their intention was to convert the old San Remo Club into a studio building. So on the same plot, there was Whedon's house, and then that house got turned into a club, and then that club burned down, and then they opened a new club, and now they were going to try to turn that club into a studio building. Their intention was to shoot pictures in that building. It was already there. Why build something new when there was already that building there? But it soon proved too small, and a new studio was ordered to be built, large enough to contain the egos of the actors being lured out to the Sunshine State from the other Sunshine State to make these pictures. But the stars, I'll be honest with you, they weren't exactly big names. Their resumes now are filled with forgotten silent films, some lost like so many other silent films, and much of their work was from two decades earlier. Like, I'm seeing people who have major movies from like 1919, like way before the 1930s. To put it bluntly, with no disrespect to those who arrived to Whedon, these weren't washed up A-list stars, these were washed up D-list stars at best. The movies that they would make on this island would reflect that, if I'm being honest with you. The first one filmed was bizarrely titled. It was called Chloe Love is Calling You. Sometimes it's just called Chloe, but I prefer that title. I watched a little bit of it, so you don't have to. It's actually on streaming services, which is crazy to me. The opening scene is three characters on a boat drifting through what appears to be a Florida wetland, probably actually filmed around Whedon Island, but it's set in Louisiana, and there was, of course, a giant alligator that was glaring at the camera. Then there was a rattlesnake that was killed. It was actually killed. I mean, it's horrible. I cannot believe that I watched a snake get killed at like the 5 minute mark of this old movie. The movie is about a voodoo priestess and a young girl that she adopts or tricks. It's pretty racist and very hacky. It's kind of a strange horror-based melodrama, but if you read any review of this movie, it is profoundly racist and has a pretty rough racist stereotype as the central figure of the movie. So spare yourself. Don't watch Chloe, Love is Calling You. All you need to know is that's a good title, and everything else, forget it. The only thing worthwhile about it is that you can see the pine forest and the mangroves of Whedon Island surrounding the tale. That's about it. The next movie produced actually brought in some quote-unquote optimism. That was Playthings of Desire, the story of some rich people falling in love. Playthings of Desire, also a great title. While the exteriors in Florida are limited in the movie itself, the involvement of the city at large was very exciting at the time. When it came to premiere the picture, they did so at the Capitol Theater in St. Petersburg, bringing in a real crowd to see the movie. Quote, "It looked as though the movie industry was here to stay, but the optimism was short-lived," end quote. Indeed, it was. But this movie's on YouTube. It exists. It's got some real style to it. I mean, it is what it is. The fact that these movies are actually getting made and attracting attention to St. Petersburg, that was the plan, right? It seemed like things were actually going their way. But they were turning these movies around quickly. I mean, they were being shot in 1933. They were coming out in 1933. It was an impressive turnaround for what was going on here. But the third film, actually probably the final film that was shot here on Whedon Island, it was called Hired Wives. But, quote, "the federal government moved in and closed down the studio for back taxes," end quote. The movie still premiered in 1934, but it seems to have vanished into history in the years since. The other two, they're online. This one, it's gone. One source says that there are prints that exist, but there are none on the web for viewing, so I can't tell you much about it. I'll keep looking. The fact that the other two are on the internet, that's a rare thing. I told you how many of these are gone, 75%. So the fact that two of the three that were shot on Whedon Island actually are there, that's pretty good. I'm pretty impressed by that. But these movies are minor things, fluff at best, and one of them is pretty racist fluff. All that effort, and in less than a year after the studio opened, they only made three movies, and then they shuttered. They were supposed to make more, and that is where our friend Buster Keaton comes in. It was during that same brief window in 1933 that Whedon actually entertained a star. He wasn't a D-list washed-up star, he was an A-list star. They actually brought him to St. Petersburg with the intention of making movies and hopes. Boy, they were running high. Buster Keaton came to town, and with him, he brought hope for a future of film production and star power to the little studio that couldn't. They were desperate. But so was he. Born Joseph Frank Keaton in 1895, Buster Keaton got his start as a member of the traveling vaudeville circuits along with his family, the entire Keaton family being themselves performers. From a young age, Buster Keaton was partaking in stunning acts of physical comedy, putting his juvenile body at risk in ways that would occasionally actually trouble audiences. He'd go flying across the stage and crash through a wall. The audience would be shocked by the comedic violence done to such a young person, only for Buster to go bursting back on stage with a smile on his face, or just acting like it wasn't anything really at all. Hence the name Buster. He was a human wrecking ball. As he got older and sought more avenues to perform his art, he soon started partnering with other comedic figures already working in silent cinema, including the great Roscoe Arbuckle. Together, they would make a handful of silent short comedies that made Buster an early star. His creative spirit would lead him to his own filmmaking endeavors, and Buster would go on to create the most luminously entertaining works of silent comedy. They still are incredibly entertaining to this day. They are still hilarious, but also magnificently made with practical stunts at the forefront done by Buster himself. He would leap from trains, fall from buildings, drive in high-speed chases, exchange blows with boxers, and go flying through the screen in marvelous, delirious action. It was almost like he was a stuntman and a magician and a brilliantly simple comedic force all at the same time. He did it all in one little body. His real power was his face. He was called the Great Stone Face. He had this notably blank expression, which could convey so little and so much at the same time. Perhaps my favorite little Buster joke is in the movie Seven Chances, a movie in which he is desperately searching for someone to marry him. After bugging every woman in one specific building, he gets a little desperate and quietly makes a little look at the hat check girl. He kind of leans on the counter like, eh, you know, maybe you and me. He slightly moves his hip like, you know, what do you think? He's been trying for about 2 seconds when the hat check girl brutally, quickly shakes her head. No, just tiny movement of the head. No. But it is paired with immediate acceptance from Buster. He kind of shakes his head back like, no, no. And she goes, nope. Just shakes her head. There's no words exchanged. It makes me laugh so hard. It's on YouTube. You know what? I'll include a link. Go watch it. It's like 10 seconds of pure comedy brilliance. It's so funny. It's so modern. I can't believe how well it works. But if you're looking for a way to learn more about his style, maybe you've never watched a silent film. That's okay. They are not as fancy or self-important as you may perceive them to be. If you've never watched a silent movie, this is a great chance for you to do so. I highly recommend his 45-minute movie, Sherlock Jr. It's on YouTube. It is such a great watch. You will have a ball, I promise, and you will be educated on this incredible era of silent comedy, and you'll get to meet one of my favorite guys, Buster Keaton. Buster was not without his flaws. His movies were often very funny and very modern, but sometimes they caught up in the tropes of the era. He would do blackface in movies sometimes, and those make those movies really hard to watch. And in fact, in one of his most action-driven, one of his most incredibly exciting stunt-filled movies, The General, he's a Confederate soldier, and he waves a giant rebel flag near the end of the movie. It dates the movies instantaneously, and the ones that feel more modern are the ones that are free from the things that have become more controversial in the last century since they came out. Nevertheless, throughout the 1920s, Buster released both short and long-form films and became Hollywood royalty. His movies were his own, with no studio oversight really, which allowed him loads of creativity and freedom to make the stories how he wanted. This made it so that when a big studio came knocking, he'd be paid handsomely to create higher quality films on a much larger budget. At least that was the idea when Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, or MGM, hired him in 1928. But things had changed quickly for Buster, and cinema had changed quickly. With synchronized sound hitting the industry the year earlier, silent pictures became instantly less profitable, and Buster's creativity was in deep conflict with the executives at MGM. As the 1930s came, his career began to fizzle. His marriage fell apart in 1932, and Buster's struggles with alcohol became more and more severe. He would get sober in 1935, a decision that would turn his life around, but the early 1930s were the doldrums of his personal and professional life. In the book Cameraman, Dana Stevens suggests that the alcoholism is actually what maybe prompted Buster to consider Florida a good idea, which I've decided to not take personally. She calls it, quote, the calamitous 9 weeks he spent in St. Petersburg, Florida, end quote. Calamitous is the word. It was only a few months earlier that he had been fired from MGM, and the Whedon Island studio came calling. Now, in Dana's book, she refers to the studio as Kennedy Productions. I told you it was Sunhaven earlier. Well, it was Kennedy Productions, then it became Sunhaven. But for the purposes of Dana's research on Buster, I will trust her research. She's the expert here. She says that it's Kennedy Productions, so that's what we will say. She says that the local paper, The Independent, had high hopes for Buster's arrival to St. Pete, saying it would make the city, quote, second only to Hollywood in the importance of the moving picture business, end quote. According to Dana, their goals were quite high. 6 movies in 2 years. He'd make $3,000 a week, which is something like $70,000 a week for today. Who wouldn't take that deal? Would you take that deal? That's a lot of money. He had an idea for a movie called The Fisherman, and he had a team ready to make it. His comeback would begin now. He came to St. Petersburg to make The Fisherman. The city was ready for him. The local news shouted it to the rooftops. Buster was given a key to the city, and every appearance he made was a press appearance. He'd be apparently followed down the street. When he went swimming, it made the paper. But he didn't seem to mind it too much, and in fact, he took part in some hobnobbing with the St. Pete residents. He would naturally spend a lot of time in local bars, and it seems like he would make a little bit of a fool for himself and take off his pants and do pantsless stunts. I don't know what that's about, Buster, but, you know, you do you, buddy. Anyway, he played in a local baseball game, actually, at one point. Get this. The team was called the Coca-Cola Bottlers. Now, you may not know this, I actually didn't know this, but Coca-Cola has a corporate foothold in Tampa Bay and has had one at least as far back as when Buster was there in the 1930s. In fact, Dana Stevens notes that Coca-Cola was an investor in Kennedy Productions, hence the name of the baseball team that was playing that day, the Coca-Cola Bottlers, which is a hilariously corporate name. I would love a Bottlers jersey. Coca-Cola, call me. Anyway, Buster, like me, was a huge baseball fan and played third base for the Bottlers one day to adoring crowds. Apparently that was his favorite spot to play. He liked the hot corner. Naturally, it was a packed house. Everyone was there for Buster. Who wouldn't want to see a celebrity play baseball, let alone a celebrity who had put baseball in his movies before? He was a huge fan, and one day, Buster played it in St. Petersburg, Florida. That's pretty special to me. But as nice as the public relations were, the production was quite the opposite. The problems were numerous despite Buster's apparent excitement about the story. Here's a short list of problems as noted at length by Dana Stevens. The soundstage was too small and incomplete. The mosquitoes were bountiful. Costumes and production equipment had to be sent from other production hubs like New York or Hollywood. The film stock itself melted. Makeup melted. And attitudes melted. Oh, and Buster Keaton, during a production shoot for the movie, apparently wearing a sombrero, was thrown from a horse. It was, frankly, a disaster. It's almost a Buster Keaton movie how many ridiculous situations befell the gang in such a short period of time. It was a mess. Buster could see the writing on the walls. This was a failure in progress. He called it quits, took his promised fee, and wished the Kennedy Productions crew well. Later in life, he would call it simply, quote, another failure on my record, end quote. Though the failure of Kennedy Productions was clearly no fault of Buster's. The movie, The Fisherman, likely never shot at all, according to Dana Stevens. If any of it was shot, none of it has survived. A blip, a forgotten one, on the long career of a legend. More movies would attempt to begin production after Buster came and went, but it was all over. 1933 was the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad year for the studio on Whedon Island, and nearly as soon as it began, it was over. In under a year, they opened, made three movies, tried to make some more, lured Buster Keaton to town, and shuttered. What a mess. As I said, Buster Keaton's life would turn around and he would go on to make more movies, make more appearances, and have a much happier latter half of his life after that. That makes me very happy. Maybe St. Petersburg was the kind of failure that brought him back to reality. The buildings of the studio on Whedon Island were torn down at some point in the last 90 years, and now they're completely gone. The St. Pete Catalyst says there is, quote, no evidence of the film buildings, end quote. Though immortalized on the quiet celluloid of these forgotten pictures, Chloe and Playthings of Desire, the abject failure of Sun Haven or Kennedy Productions is lost to time. All that we can picture of it now is on those faded film reels in the background of these little stories from long ago. Maybe if Buster had gotten what he wanted, if he had actually shot even just a short film on Whedon Island, that studio would have much, much more of a legacy, or any legacy at all. But based on how it all went down, it felt like a transplant that was doomed from the beginning. You can build a casino in a swamp, sure, but not a movie studio. Though I wish there was some evidence, even a fragment of the old studio there. We've made a lot of movies in Florida over the years. Just because this was the biggest failure of those efforts doesn't mean we shouldn't remember it. They had no chance. The dominoes were falling before Buster even arrived. With the film industry evolving and St. Petersburg economy finding its feet again, that's hardly the ecosystem to bring the glitz and glamour of cinema to the Sunshine State. It wasn't ready. But that's the great joy of failure. Sometimes. Sometimes you learn from it, you get better, and you fail a little less the next time. Sometimes. And other times, the cards get drawn wrong, the coin lands tails, and the mosquitoes ruin the film shoot. Just like Buster Keaton wheeling across the silent screen for generations, sometimes you just fall flat on your face. And that is okay too. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wait 5 Minutes. I am so glad that you are here. If you enjoyed this show, or if you know someone who would enjoy this show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Send it to a friend. Send the Instagram or Facebook to a friend of yours, or send me an email at wfmpod@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you. If you do enjoy this story about Buster Keaton and you found yourself watching some Buster Keaton clips, please let me know. It would mean the world to me to have brought some of my favorite art to this audience and for you to enjoy some of the things that I've gotten to enjoy and celebrate on this show. So thank you for listening. She wasn't on the episode, but I must give a huge thank you to Dana Stevens for her incredible book. I will include a link to it so you can check it out. If you are a cinema fan, if you like this story, go give that book a read. It is really a worthwhile read. I'm a huge fan. I've also included some links to the Whedon book and a little bit of Buster's own movie, so you can go and watch some yourself and get a little acclimated to his work. So thank you to Dana. Thank you to the Whedon Island book, and thank you for listening. All the music used in this episode was originally composed. You know, before I go, I hope you noticed, I just have to say this before I go. The 5 stories so far this season are kind of connected. Buffalo Bill Cody, early entertainment leading into Buster, and then there's Prohibition with Buster at the same time. We talk about this lost media of the black newspapers that Zora published in, the same as the lost media from the silent films. And then, of course, you know, you have Satchel Paige later in life coming back to Florida trying to find a revival, the same as Buster Keaton. I didn't mean for it to be this way. It's just these 5 stories that really interested me, and it just so happens that there's these weird little ties that kind of bring them all together. That's Florida sometimes. So to me, these are kind of a 5-part miniseries of biographies of incredible people that I'm a huge admirer of and the little ways that they interconnect together. Next week, however, we're going surging into the present. We've done so many historical topics, but we've got 3 big modern stories for you in a row, and 2 of them are about Tallahassee. The Florida legislative session just ended, but a couple weeks ago, I got to spend an entire day at the legislature with Representative Anna V. Escamani. I'm going to tell you about our day, the things that I learned, and then the week after that, we're going to have a long conversation with Anna Escamani in her office after our long day together. So those are going to be sort of a 2-parter exploring our time together at the legislature. It was an incredibly interesting time. And then the week after that, we're going to talk about some of the bills that were moving through the legislature and some that have passed, including one about black bears. I'm very eager to tell you that story because it's a developing story and it's a big one. So we'll be back next week with my trip to the legislature. I've been waiting to tell you this story for a long time, and I'm really excited for you to hear this episode. Until then, be good to yourself, be good to others, drink more water, and go Gator and muddy the water. Have a great week. I will see you next Monday.